Welcome aboard, you people. It is the Starship Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis up for another day of broadcast episodes.
To be honest, did you download Total Eclipse of the Heart today?
I did not, but I did see, of all the coverage today of the eclipse, mm-hmm. one of the coolest moments, maybe the coolest moment, other than, of course, Tom Skilling, which was amazing. Mm. You know, especially to have Tom Skilling, who's such a familiar personality to sure. Chicagoans. He's like a member of the family. Mm-hmm. And then to watch him have this emotional reaction to what he was seeing and to see it go to almost total darkness and then everybody kind of turn around. It was sort of like the back 40 at Woodstock. You know, it was like everybody kind of hugging. Is that Jimi Hendrix? God, I love you, man.
It really did get emotional.
It was really cool. But then this was wild. You know, I think it was Royal Caribbean.
Mm-hmm. International Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines.
Right. They went out into the Straits of Florida to catch this thing mm-hmm. and found a patch of clear sky. They were motoring, at top speed to try to find, to get away from the clouds. Mm-hmm. And there was a CNN reporter on board. And maybe there were more.
I saw it on ABC, too.
And when it happened, it was so dark. Mm-hmm. It was amazing what happened out there. Because, the ocean is dark to begin with. It just is. It's just like at night. It's a scary place at night, be out in the ocean.
It kind of is. And that might have been one of the scarier places to be, if you think about it. But so cool at the same time. And then she was singing Total Eclipse of the Heart on board and gave a lot of interviews.
Yeah.
About how everyone's downloading her music, 300,000 or something.
Yeah. No, I did. Oh, yeah. This is
the most downloaded
did
song.
Did she ever
on
know
iTunes?
That this? Thank God. She's got another one coming in 7 years. I hope she can hold on.
Actually, she said even during partial eclipses and other eclipse related, phenomena, she's actually had more downloads on those days, too. She's riding on this.
She'd only thought about this. This is just a happy accident, I'm sure.
Yeah, I tried playing it on YouTube. It wasn't loading. Probably
right.
too many people.
So too many people watching it.
I watched it, too, off YouTube, and it did load. But we were listening to it while the eclipse was going.
I'm like, come on, I'm going to miss it. The eclipse is moving, people.
Mm-hmm.
My data is not working.
I like how Violetta is mad at nature and high technology. She's mad at the sun, the moon, and at iTunes all at the same time.
I just found it remarkable. I was on a rooftop in the West Loop, and nobody was on the street in the middle of a busy lunch hour. Nobody was driving. Everybody, and in downtown, too. You saw the pictures in the Loop of people.
Staring.
Just staring.
Ow!
That's most of them wearing glasses.
Ow!
Other than Ro.
Hey, I'm worried about you. I hope you did not look at it, because sometimes you don't figure out the damage for a while.
I kept giving myself like a 1,000 check to mm-hmm. do it. Like, I would look up and then go 1,000, 2,000, and then look down.
Oh,
but as soon as you focus on it,
yes.
it's like, ow!
It hurt. Yeah.
It just sounds painful.
It was.
Why were you doing it to yourself?
Wait, I don't know. I'm an idiot. My left eye feels a little funny. I don't know what it is.
Are you seeing spots?
Gosh.
Yeah.
Your vision
and
had a good run.
I was, yeah. Quite honestly, I've seen everything I need to see.
Seen it all. I'm done.
You're
seen
done
it all now.
Things.
Right. There were moments.
You'd
there,
like to unsee some things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A few. Yeah. There's a few I'd like to see again, but there's a lot I'd like to really unsee.
That's not how it works, though, unfortunately.
No. Mm-mm. So we are, so it's going to be very exciting stuff, though, because we got a lot going on here. And today on the program, I should mention. And first of all, as I mentioned, Skilling and Sapels are both here.
Yes.
Good. Thank God.
Thank God.
For that. Josh Green's going to join us. He wrote Devil's Bargain, the book about Steve Bannon. We had him on a couple weeks ago mm-hmm. when it first came out. It's number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and he's going to talk about Steve Bannon. Now that Steve Bannon has left,
mm-hmm.
wow.
What's he going to do?
Oh, well, he's already doing it. He attended a Breitbart editorial meeting within hours of the leaving the White House.
And you saw one of the editors at Breitbart immediately tweet out hashtag war.
Yeah.
So it's curious to see who the war is with.
I was off on Friday because I was
at a Breitbart meeting.
I was at a White House meeting about Bannon. I was with Jovanka, as Bannon calls
mm-hmm.
them.
Did not like the Jovanka.
Yeah.
Felt that way too much power.
Jared and Ivanka, and I was with them, and I was holding was holding her, both of their hands. Quite honestly, they were both a little nervous, shaken by this whole thing. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about what all that means moving forward here. Plus, the president does have a major announcement tonight at 8 o'clock, and then we'll be everybody will be taking that live as he's going to make a decision on Afghanistan. And the interesting thing is that you could tell that Kelly's got some hands on deck here because no one's leaking what the decision is. Mm-hmm. Now, part of the speculation there is that no one knows what the decision is, including the president. And then he'll make that decision when he gets up there tonight.
Minute by minute.
Yeah, but I think the decision has been made, and General Mattis is, you know, or soon to be made. I mean, this could be one of those things where 4 hours before there's another consultation. Are you sure? Like an initial decision made there. Are you sure? And then they go with it tonight. Mm-hmm. And it will be written for him. It's not going to be very long presentation, we're told, but he will be there. And then tomorrow night he's going to be in Phoenix. That's going to be a little more interesting because that's going to be like a campaign style rally that he's been doing. And there is speculation he is going to, during the rally, that he is going to publicly pardon Joe Arpaio, the now federally convicted sheriff of Maricopa County. Mm-hmm. The guy, remember the guy that made the prisoners wear pink and
very
gave them bologna sandwiches and tent cities and things like that? Quite controversial sheriff. Mm-hmm. Convicted on a technical situation concerning his adherence to a federal order that stopped the idea of making traffic stops based on race, right? Mm-hmm. So that whole racial profiling issue, and there was there specifically was an injunction against that kind of behavior, and Arpaio continued to do it and knowingly doing it, and then he got convicted of contempt, essentially, and it's not that it would necessarily cost him any prison time because no one thought that. But what it could potentially do is, you know, keep him from being able to get his pension and things like that.
Right.
So that's where the president would be stepping in.
So the mayor of Phoenix is saying, cancel your visit, president, if you intend to pardon our Sheriff Arpaio, because we don't want that here.
All right, well, we'll see what happens here. It's all coming your way. But first, Violetta Podomatic is going to put on, she's wearing her glasses, which are the cardboard ones. Are those the real ones?
These are definitely real. They're from the Adler Planetarium, so they say.
Who's they that say that?
Well, they say Adler Planetarium on them, but I got them from those double-decker buses. If you buy a ticket, you got the glasses.
Did you get a ticket?
Well, I convinced the kid that I wasn't going on the bus and I'd give him $20 if he gave me these. So kind of.
I hope they're the real deal because I use those today. I don't need to go blind.
I like how she did that. Here's a 20.
That's the Chicago way, right?
Well, I'm
here a second.
I was like, I have 20. And I was like, can I just give you
20
these?
20 goes a long way in this town.
Yeah.
Oh, 20
Doesn't
goes
it?
20 gets you anything in this
Lots
town.
Lots of good tables are found by $20.
Exactly.
Hey, hopefully I didn't burn my retinas, but yeah.
Hey, I got an Andy Jackson I want you to meet right here, okay? All right.
It's always the exchange, too, the way they grab onto the hand. Yeah. Kind of just a big presentation.
You fold it and you just you shake the guy's hand. Hey, no, I think you say so much. Rokan Show with Anna DeBlantis right here on 720 WGN.
Yes.
All right. I'm not going to get all goofy about this, but Thursday, you know, I was off on Friday, mm-hmm. Mark Sapel. So Thursday, you're on with us, you know, we're having a normal conversation. Couldn't tell anything.
No.
Couldn't tell a thing. Nothing. And we're just talking. Oh, eclipse this, you know, Trump that, you know, whatever it is. Right?
Yes.
Bears. We get down, we toss over to news. And I'm just doing my normal thing. I look at my phone, and all of a sudden it's blowing up with people going, "Hey, Sapelsa just retired from broadcasting." And I'm like,
"We looked at each other like, no, come on.
Is it something I said? What did I do? It's like I forced you into it. What did you do? What did you do?
What are you doing?
Yeah, what are you doing?
Well, you know, at that moment, because I distinctly remember, because I think we got done at about 3:35.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 3:50, I believe, 3:50, 3:55, I sent out an email to my colleagues here in TV. And I hadn't done that yet. And so I couldn't say anything to my friends Ro and Anna, nor the wonderful WGN Radio listenership.
Without telling them, I get it.
You know how that goes?
Yeah, I do.
So, and I was supposed to do it. I was planning on doing it about 10 to 5, but then I didn't realize until later, right after I got off the air with you, that Ben Bradley was not here for the 4 o'clock.
So you had to do the 4 o'clock.
So I had to jam all that stuff into about 15 minutes.
Oh,
it was crazy.
Okay, so just so I understand this, because this is fascinating to me, because one day I hope to, you know, you are a, you know, you're a hero of mine in this business. There are very, very, very few people actually in this business that I know, like, and respect that have all of that. That's a, it's a small bucket of people, and of course all the present company here. But you know, you and Ron Majors, who you know I think are cut from very much the same cloth. And this is a, you know, that was a, right out of the Majors playbook right there, pal. I was sort of like, you know what I'm doing? I'm going to go on the news, but I'm going to let everybody know I am resigning and retiring from the business. Was it a complete surprise to everybody there?
It was. Yeah. I don't think there was anybody that really expected it. My wife and I had been talking about it for a couple of years. You know, you don't do this stuff like that. You don't do it in 2 months. You don't do it in 6 months. So we in fact, I had one of our reporters got an email from a former intern of mine who said, I was 19 years old as an intern at Channel 5 for Mark Sapelsa, and he was discussing his retirement plans. And that was 20 years ago. You know, so I'd always had those thoughts of, you know, I don't want to be the last one out the door where I got to turn the lights off and I got a cane in my hand. So, I had made plans along these lines for a long, long time. But, no, nobody here really knew at all. And I had a good agent, Mr. Todd Musburger, who said, "Keep your mouth shut because if you open your mouth, the world will know eventually."
Out. Yes, that's true.
Yeah, and so that was it.
But you said you really are once you're done at WGN Channel 9, you're going to move to Montana eventually, right? And then you're not going to dip your toe back into the waters of broadcasting.
No.
That's not the plan.
No, it really is not the plan. I definitely plan to and expect to just completely unplug and walk away.
Except for 3:20.
Every day.
Every
Monday
day
through
when
Friday.
You
get
home.
Yeah, that's still part of it, right? That doesn't go away.
If I see pomegranate on my phone, I'll answer. I promise.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Yeah.
I'm in Montana.
She works with us every day, and I don't do that. I see that phone ringing. I'm like, oh, no, God, oh, God. I call the producer and go, is she arrested?
What's going
Just
on?
Let me know what happened
Give
to her.
Give me a heads up.
Yeah.
End call.
All right. So,
that's it.
That is amazing. So, and it is an interesting moment. Would you say, though, I wonder this, as you look at your career, because you're 55 years old. Just
right.
A few years older than I am, just 2 years older than I am. And it freaked me out, man, because I always kind of looked at you as a contemporary and as a guy that, and I'm like,
yeah, we'll retire about the same time, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm thinking, and like, you know, between me and my God and my accountant, we've decided that I'm working until I'm like 75. So,
different plan.
Right, and a few of the lawyers they've all figured it out. And so when you announce this, I'm like, oh my God, what great planning on your part. That was amazing.
It's true. It's an example.
You are. So you're always on top of things, though. I mean, this is the most amazing thing. Mm-hmm. And I got to give you credit. You know, I mean, people know the story, and I know we're not speaking out of school here, but, you know, when you went into recovery,
right?
You know, you
five
did
and
it.
5 years ago, yeah.
You did it like on your own. It was like you woke up one morning and you were like, this is wrong. I can't live like this.
Yeah, right. My wife woke me up one morning and said, this is wrong. I can't live with this.
So she's smart, too.
Yeah, she was. No, right. And it was like a 3 a.m. revelation where she said, essentially, what are you doing? And I said, you know what? I don't know. And I've been doing this for too long. So you are correct. That's kind of how it went down. It wasn't a big explosion. It wasn't a big kaboom. It was just like, you know what? I think I need help.
So at this point, you woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, Mark Sapelsa, and you said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to resign. I'm going to retire. I'm going to do this. I know you can't tell every story right now, but
right.
You will eventually.
Yeah, I know.
I just want to know, How many of your colleagues came by, including Ben Bradley, I know it was the first one, came by and started measuring your office? How many did that?
I asked him about that. I'm like, who gets the office?
Well, actually, somebody just said a few minutes ago, I was talking to one of our wonderful reporters, Amy Rutledge, and she said, I love the email chain that you sent out the email and then everybody responded back. And about 50% were, can I have the office?
Yeah.
Can I have the parking spot? Right. Can I get your coffee maker?
I'm sure that's true. Were your bosses... may I ask this question? Were your bosses unaware of this?
They were unaware of it.
How did that go down?
Well, here's what I did. About 48 hours beforehand, I asked if I could have a meeting with, before my usual work time, with the news director and the general manager. Wonderful people. And I'm telling you, they are wonderful people. And they said, oh, someone's not available this day. Someone's not available. How about Thursday? This is like on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And so... they had 48 hours to think about it, and they told me, they mulled it over for 48 hours. What is he going to talk about? What does he want to meet about before work? That doesn't usually happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when I said, I did not sleep much the night before.
I bet.
Because, in large part, because, see, I've left, and I think I might have said this to Anna on Friday, but I have left three TV stations, one in Minneapolis and two in Chicago, mm-hmm. where I was kind of in a contract fight. Always,
yeah. You know, not the case here.
No, and you know, so I've left three TV stations where I essentially was punching management in the nose and going, I couldn't wait for that day. You know, this day I could not get myself to walk into the office and say, you guys have been so good to me, but I'm making a decision. At the end of my contract, I'm going to retire. And the news director said, she actually sighed and said, that's what I thought.
Wow.
And so I think they had talked about it, discussed what this, that, you know, that type of thing. And so I think that they were certainly surprised, but I think they had had some time to think, what would this be?
Yeah. All right. Well, congratulations on a remarkable career.
Thank
congratulations on being a superstar in your own town and being a guy who did change the landscape here, because you really did all of that.
Well, I think your words are too lofty for me. But
Trust me, I know when I'm being too lofty, and most everybody else does. But in your particular case, I mean, there are very few people who've done the job that you've done, worked in the industry that we all work in, and made a change in this town, and you're one of them. So,
thank you, Rokan. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And your entire staff, and not to get too sappy, but the WGN listeners, thank you so much for all the support and the kind email, text, Twitter, all that sort of stuff. And, Rose, seriously, those words mean a ton, and I will put them in my back pocket and cherish them.
All right. So I'm going to get out and never darken our door again. All right. We'll see you not at 4 o'clock because you got baseball, but we'll see you maybe late tonight. I don't know.
Yes.
Yes.
We've got, I think we got the Trump announcement at 8. We'll have that live, and then 9 and 10.
Gotcha.
All right.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much. Mark
Sapelson.
Okay, we'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you.
All right. It's not, you know, now it's a long goodbye. Now it's a
I know. To do. Well, that's good, though. It's not as sudden. I hate sudden goodbyes.
Oh, man. What a good guy Mark Sapelson is. Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis right here on 720 WGN. Josh Green is with us. He is the author of Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency, number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Congratulations to you, sir, on that. That's a pretty great accomplishment.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And let us, we talked to you a couple weeks ago when the book first came out, and Steve Bannon was still there, but there was a little bit of this kind of movement around it, like, I don't know how long he's going to be here. And then last Monday when the president, or Tuesday when the president made his, as some are calling it, the off-the-rails press availability at the Trump Tower, he was asked about Bannon, and he goes, he's a great guy, he's a friend of mine, but he came on late in the campaign. Already won all these other states, and we'll just have to see what happens that we did
we'll
on Friday.
See.
No surprise, right?
No, not at all, because Trump is very defensive about the main thesis of my book, which is that Steve Bannon was the decisive factor in the election, and that without Bannon having come on late in the campaign, not only pioneered Trump's nationalist politics, but also kind of built this machine that I talk about that spent years tearing down Hillary Clinton. Without all that, I don't think Trump would have eked out the win that he did. But of course, Trump is famous for not wanting to share credit or have co-stars. And so you could kind of sense that even as he was defending Bannon against charges of racism and being a part of the alt-right, you know, he also kind of added, oh, by the way, I am the guy responsible for my victory, not Steve Bannon.
Yeah, you heard that for sure loud and clear. And it's said that the president is aware of your book and its contents and has said that he doesn't like it for that very reason, that you view it projects Bannon as this puppet master character in charge of all strategy and that the president is just sort of being pulled in all directions. The one thing that's interesting, though, is what the predictions of what will happen now is now that Steve Bannon is no longer there. And he was the one who said, don't give any ground to your enemies, your critics, don't apologize. He was the one after the Charlottesville saying, no, 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 don't correct it, don't go back. It doesn't, they're just going to say it took too long and it was wrong. Do you think that he had such influence like that, that we will see a notable difference?
Here's the thing about Trump and Bannon. I think that the two of them, what they believe in their hearts overlaps pretty closely. And there was a lot of anguish in the West Wing among Trump's advisors that Bannon was a negative influence on Charlottesville, that by encouraging Trump not to come out immediately and condemn the Nazis and white supremacists, that Bannon was this pernicious influence who was leading the president astray. But if you listen to Trump's press conference the other day, it was clear that this was coming from Trump's heart. This was emotional. Yeah. He was mad at the charges that he should have to apologize for this. He was mad at the criticism. No advisor can spin you into believing that way. Trump believes that anyway. And that's why I think that even though Bannon is out of the White House, we're not really going to see much of a change from Trump at all.
Well, I guess the question is, what will Bannon do outside the White House? Because I know there was an argument, and I know that we talked about this when you were on a couple weeks ago, when the book first came out. There is some concern about whether he's more valuable by keeping him inside and containing him, or is he dangerous by letting him out and shoot back at the White House against who he perceives to be his agenda and the president, you know, potentially the president's agenda's enemies within.
That is the big open question. I mean, now Bannon is back at Breitbart News. He just met the other night with Robert Mercer, the right-wing billionaire, who is going to fund an expansion of Breitbart. So Bannon has back this public platform that for all the influence and the chaos he caused inside the White House, he was a government employee. He was relatively bottled up and couldn't speak his mind very often, although he did do so from time to time. Now, however, he has this what he called a killing weapon in an interview the other day of Breitbart News to go after directly members of the media, people in corporate America, and especially his political opponents. And one thing that I know from talking to Bannon, I spoke to him just after he left the White House, that includes not just Democrats, but Republicans, including, I suspect, some senior officials in Trump's White House. So that could be a real problem for Trump and the White House moving forward if you have this outside force coming after people in your administration.
Would he go after the kids?
Well, he already is. I mean, it was funny. You know, Trump, I think, is very nervous about the influence that Bannon might wield on the outside. And about a day after he left, Trump sent a tweet out saying, you know, congratulations to Steve Bannon heading back to the wonderful Breitbart News. Well, within 24 hours of that tweet, Breitbart was running articles attacking Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter. So I don't think there's any doubt that Bannon and Breitbart are going to be willing to go after Trump's children, and in particular his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, if they don't like the policies that they're following.
Where does Trump land on that if they go after the kids?
That's a great question. I mean, Trump, on the one hand, seems to have allowed some of this stuff, some of this criticism of Kushner, and even of his daughter, because, you know, she, for instance, was trying to keep him to leave the U.S. inside the Paris Climate Accords. He didn't. That brought a lot of heat from the right wing, from Breitbart News. But it's a little awkward if you have this outside entity attacking your family members. So I think it remains to be seen how Trump is going to react, especially if that criticism moves from going after Trump's children to perhaps going after Trump himself.
Okay. We'll just stop on that for a second, Josh. Do you think Breitbart would go, or not Breitbart, but Bannon, using Breitbart, would go after Donald Trump himself?
know, I'm not sure. Bannon has always said that as important a figure as Trump is, he's really part of a larger movement. It's the movement that Bannon believes in. Bannon thought that Trump could be a vehicle to advance this movement, was a vehicle to advance this movement. But now, as he said to the Weekly Standard, the Trump presidency is over, at least the Bannon chapter of it, so he's moved to the outside. The question is, I think in the short term, Bannon thinks that Trump can still be a vehicle for his ideas. But if it becomes clear to him at some point that Trump cannot, or that Trump is more interested in listening to his moderate advisors, then I think there'll be a real question. Does Bannon decide it's in his interests to attack Trump directly as a sellout to the cause in hopes of galvanizing Republican sentiment toward the ideas that Trump ran on?
Won't tonight be one of those chapters, the beginning of one of those chapters, as he discusses his Afghanistan policy?
Well, tonight really marks a loss, a policy loss for Bannon. He had fought against the national security establishment, the national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, Defense Secretary Mattis, who wanted to boost U.S. troops in Afghanistan rather than withdraw them as Bannon wanted and as Trump promised on the campaign trail. So one of the reasons I think Bannon got pushed out is that he lost that policy fight. But we've already seen, looking at Breitbart News today, that they're very critical of both of those generals and are not going to hesitate to be an outside voice of criticism from the right on Trump's foreign policy.
One of the headlines right now on Breitbart, with Steve Bannon out, globalists push for more war abroad, and say exactly what you're talking about, criticize H.R. McMaster and others within the administration.
That's exactly right. And if it turns out that Breitbart can really rally grassroots conservative sentiment to those ideas and to the ideas that Trump is a warmonger, that could be a real problem for him in his reelection, certainly, but even before then.
It's interesting because we have to look at this in two ways here in terms of, you know, you've got personalities like Donald Trump and Steve Bannon, but you also, I think you're pointing to and you point to in your book, that there is devil's bargain, that there is, in fact, you know, there's this rise of nationalism in the United States anyway. And the question is, where does that end? I think for a lot of people, other than those on the nationalist side of it, there's a lot of fear of that because you've seen nationalism rise and fall in Europe and other places and Asia for the last century and with disastrous results. And what is surprising to me is that those, and Steve Bannon's a smart guy, and he's made a lot of money in America. I mean, he was, you know, he's one of the money side producers of Seinfeld, for God's sake, you know, all the products you could be associated with and sort of not think about it. Does he not have a sense of the disaster that comes from nationalism?
No, not at all. He thinks it's the key to American renewal, to global renewal, really. I mean, he spent time agitating with Nigel Farage for the Brexit campaign in Great Britain. He's given supportive words to nationalist politicians like Marine Le Pen in France. Bannon very much believes, rightly or wrongly, that nationalism is the way forward, and he's going to do everything within his power to advance it, not just in the U.S., but abroad.
Did you notice a lot of, you interview both of them, Bannon and the president, for this book and sat down with them for lengthy interviews. Did you notice a lot of similarities did you notice a lot of similarities?
At the time I did because they were really both on the same page and, you know, Trump obviously had won this amazing upset victory that shocked the world. But since then, I think that their views have diverged. I mean, Bannon remains loyal to the core set of ideas that he handed to Trump in the campaign and that really got him elected, whereas Trump at times has been willing to waver and veer off in a different direction, his policy in Afghanistan being just one example.
Do you have a sense that tomorrow night when he goes to Phoenix and he makes his speech in Phoenix that he is going to pardon Joe Arpaio?
You know, I don't know. That would be a very Bannon-like move. So one of the things that I'm going to be watching for is, does Trump really change course? Does he steer toward the middle and some of his more moderate advisors? Or does he keep doing what he was doing anyway and essentially following Bannon in spirit, even if he is not still his chief advisor in the White House? And I'm not sure we know the answer yet.
Did you get a sense that Bannon was talking to the president every day?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was throughout Charlottesville. He pretty much has been for the last year or so. And, you know, Trump is famous for reaching out to people, even people he's fired, like Corey Lewandowski and Paul Manafort. He would still call them and solicit advice.
Yeah, I wouldn't call Manafort if I were him.
Well, maybe not Manafort anymore.
Not him.
But
little distance. Couldn't hurt.
Yeah, I wouldn't have that phone record if I were him. All right.
Yeah, lawyers have probably erased that number from his cell phone.
Well, I can't find it. Where is it?
I want to tweet him.
All right, Josh, thank you so much. Joshua Green, author of Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, the Storming the Presidency, number one bestseller right now on the New York Times bestseller list. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
This is amazing. Oh, my God. Oh, my word. That. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. Right. I did miss karaoke last night.
There's Tom Skilling.
Wasn't it beautiful?
From a couple of hours ago.
Just watching him. Oh, made you happy. Guy like him who got that emotional about it. He felt good.
Here is Tom Skilling from Right This Moment. I'm assuming you're stuck in traffic right now on your way back up 57.
Do you know something? Guys, it is amazing. We had been wondering where all the crowds were until we went out to this campground where we originated our coverage. And we had started in Carbondale the day before, did some reporting from the SIU campus, but we decided to go out to a campground. This thing was crammed. And so we're just driving back into Carbondale again from this campground, having cleaned everything up after the broadcast. And my God, all these fast food places are full of people here, and the traffic is something else. So I think what happened is a lot of folks came in nights before, and there's a lot of terrain, a lot of open ground down here for viewing the eclipse. And so I think you could spread a lot of people over a large area, but now as they all exit in unison, it's becoming clear how many people actually were down here.
Yeah.
And it was stunning. I'll tell you something. You read about these things and you think, but when you see it, it is, it's really quite a cosmic experience, as many people say. I mean, you are kind of overtaken by it. It's really amazing. It's funny, when partial eclipse starts, and it started around 11:52 here, but I would say it was about 1:15 when all of a sudden, as we got close to totality at 1:20, everything goes dark, and you see light around the horizon, as if the sun is starting to rise, but it's completely dark everywhere else. I mean, it's like you've suddenly moved within 5 minutes time into nighttime, and you've got this, black disk of the moon with the corona of the sun bleeding out of the perimeter of it. But that's what you see up there where the sun once was. The stars are out. You can see the planets. Mm-hmm. The blue sky is gone. It's now a deep and dark twilight. And the temperature drop, which was,
you
was
feel
great
it.
Down here because, it is punishingly hot down here. This is the summer that's been going on down here outside the Chicago area downstate for much of the summer. We've missed it time and time again as these winds come off the lake and moderate the temperature. So believe me, we ought to be happy we are where we are because it is punishingly hot down here. Really steamy. But I'll tell you, everybody we talked to after it said it exceeded their farthest expectations. And, I mean, these were young people and old people alike. And there is quite a crowd down here that has taken this in. So I'm telling you, guys, it was worth seeing.
Well, it was worth
seeing. And I would highly
you.
Recommend it in the future.
You got me all choked up, Tom, when you started crying during that. I got very emotional because, to see a guy like you who knows so much about science, to be moved by it, and then you're singing, it just felt like a big old party down there.
Well, it's funny. You don't intend to do that.
No.
I remember there was a piece in the New York Times written by Heather McDonald, and she described her they did a special section on the eclipse, and she described her first encounter with the eclipse, and she said, she fell to her knees and started sobbing.
Wow.
And, it's funny, you don't realize that that's going to be your reaction,
No, you don't. It was your first? Was it your first eclipse?
Yeah, it was. I had seen a annular eclipse before. I'd never seen the total eclipse. But I'm telling you, there's something about it. It's almost a religious experience.
It is.
I remember she also made the comment in this article that she always thought this was something she should see by herself. And she learned very quickly that, no, it's better to be with a group of people. There's something about sharing this experience with your fellow human being that has greater meaning to you. And it really is a very moving experience. But
what's interesting was watching you at that moment. Mm-hmm. And obviously you got choked up. And then you immediately turned. I don't even know if you, when you look at the tape of this, you'll see this.
Yeah.
You immediately looked for another.
It's going to be a while, bro, before I get up to looking at the tape. I don't like watching.
Yeah, I know. I understand. I understand. But yeah. this is a very special moment in Chicago television because you turned to this another, I guess, to the closest person to you other than your camera person. And there was a woman behind you, and you just turned and you just embraced her.
Oh.
And it was like this moment. It was the kind of what everybody was doing there, mm-hmm. because you have this sort of ethereal thing that you're looking at, and the magnitude of the universe hits you at that moment. Would that be the way to describe that?
I think that's exactly what it is, Ro. In a funny sort of way, you know, I didn't even realize I had done that. It's hard to describe how you're overwhelmed with it. But apparently it's not an unusual reaction, because in reading literature on this, I've read others who have been struck the same way. And it's it comes off as something you've never seen before. And, to suddenly remove the sun that we're so used to seeing all the time and go into total darkness. I mean, it was like,
it's kind of a big deal.
I know, it's the weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life. And yet I've read since I was a little boy about, you know, solar eclipses. So you've got to see it yourself to understand this. And I'm sure there's some people saying, oh my God, what a total overreaction.
Oh, no.
But I don't know. You're just kind of gripped by the thing at the moment. And I'll tell you, everybody we came in contact with, there are a lot of good people in this world. And if you doubt it, it's an event like this that brings everybody together. And, somehow all the other stuff that's going on in this crazy world doesn't matter as much. You know, you just realize that there are an awful lot of good people out there, mm-hmm. and that we're all there to kind of see nature doing something pretty special. So it was an amazing
that
experience.
That was one of the things, Tom, that stuck out to me, because people seem so civil and so in this together.
Yeah.
And even on the way back with the traffic jam, some of the reporters were out there interviewing people, and they're like, I don't care how long it takes to get home. It's worth it. And it felt like, you know, there's this great spirit about the whole experience.
Yeah, you know, and Anna, you're so right. You put it so beautifully. And here are a bunch of people that took time off to drive great distances. We had people there from Australia. There's a fellow from the UK, a gentleman, a professor of astrophysics we interviewed from New Hampshire. There's a fellow from Canada, up in Ontario, Canada, that came down. And somehow it didn't matter where you were from or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You were just there for that moment to watch nature doing something very, very special that none of us had ever seen nature do before. And I guess it makes you realize the whole thing is a lot bigger than all of us, you know? Mm-hmm.
I will say about all of those warnings, don't look at it, don't look at it, don't look at it. And Kevin just had a great quote from one of those tough guys. Was it a football coach?
Boston College Steve Adazio.
Yeah, a football coach is sort of like, I stared at it with my own eyes. If I'm blind tomorrow, I'll let you know. You know, but the thing is, and I, you know, I'm a wuss. I'm not a guy who likes physical pain.
I know a lot of things.
Yeah, and so I looked. I mean, who does? But I have a particularly bad tolerance for it. So I had my sunglasses on, and I wasn't going to look at it, but what I was going to do is I was going to go out there and I was going to use my phone mm-hmm. to sort of look through my screen of the phone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because I was not as lucky. I didn't realize you could pay off somebody like Violetta did and just get the glasses,
went a different route.
I'm looking at my phone, and then every once in a while I put the phone down and threw these glasses around the about the first, after the first quarter and before the totality, not totality here, but the apex of it here.
Mm-hmm.
there was, you could see it. I mean, it was cloudy here, and it was through the haze of the, so I figured, well, I'm getting a little bit of protection from the clouds here, and so I looked up a couple times, and then I was like, ah, and then I would look back down. But I found
it hurt even to look, like, not even straight at the
sun. Right, sort of indirectly.
Still was very, like, well, it didn't work.
But you could see it, like, for the second and a half or 2 seconds or whatever it was, I could actually focus on it. Mm-hmm. You actually saw it, and it was like, and you see this chunk, this round, you know, perfect ellipse out of the sun. And you're like, oh, my God.
It was crazy.
What is that? Now, you had the experience of a lifetime. Would you rank this, Tom, in terms of, obviously, this is a confluence of your science, your life's work, and then, you know, having a moment like this. But is this the top? Where would you put it?
Oh, this is, you know, we did a tornado chase. That was fascinating. This is just in a league all its own. You know, I don't know what you compare it to. It doesn't last terribly long, but you watch nature do stuff you had never seen it do before. I never saw daylight disappear so quickly. You know, you go into it 30, 45 minutes, you think, oh, and I'd read about this ahead of time. They said, you know, you're not going to be impressed with what you see at first. But then it's that 5 minutes, either side of totality, bam, it takes place really fast. And to remove daylight at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and go to total darkness. The one thing for which we're grateful, the weather cooperated. I'm looking now down here. We just came up to Carbondale, where we've been staying. By the way, we've been staying with a very interesting couple who rented out their pool house here. The gentleman is a former New York Times photographer, and his wife is a professor of anthropology. What an interesting couple. And there's a group in from Wisconsin here who's staying as well, and it's just kind of fun to talk to everybody. But this is definitely up there in the top tier of my experiences, and I would recommend it to anybody. Well, you know, there's one in 2024, and it'll be down here
in Carbondale again.
Carbondale, yeah.
I'm going. I'm taking off work wherever I am, just so you guys know.
Yeah, we
think you would love it. There were a lot of young people down here, and I mean really young, and even they seemed to realize the magnitude of what they were seeing and what they had seen. And I asked everybody afterwards, did a little informal poll, well, what did you think of it? Did it exceed your expectations? Did it meet them? Everybody said, oh, no, at some level it was beyond what they had expected, even with all the literature out there about what you're going to see. So it was stunning, but I'll tell you it's kind of fun to get together and do something with a whole group of people and from all different backgrounds, all different areas, and to do so lovingly. You know, there was spirit of camaraderie and all together.
Yeah. It was Woodstock for the world.
Yes.
Yeah, they called it Geek Woodstock, but I don't think it was just geeks who was Woodstock for. I think it was everybody.
No, that's a good way to put it. A Geek Woodstock,
Yeah, but I think it was beyond geeks, though, because that's a moment where, you know, you cannot help but be struck. I mean, you learn, if you look at the literature, you know, you were talking about the literature of experiences in this. I mean, eclipses have caused wars and other sorts of things, because, you know, but the ancients weren't exactly sure what the hell was going on.
And
especially the ones who were, and, you know, there was always a moment where it was the cusp of science and politics, you know, and so that you know, the politicians were fighting against the scientists that didn't agree with them. Does it sound like anything that we think about today?
It's relevant.
But, it was really funny.
You know, what's interesting about this, you look at some of the stories with this. Do you know Christopher Columbus used an eclipse when he landed in Jamaica? The native folks there were so scared by what was going on. He convinced them that it was his God warning them that they had to feed his crew. And they ended up feeding his crew because he said, this was my God mad, and you ought to see what he does when he's really mad. So he was frightened. There was supposedly when one of King Henry's died, there was an eclipse right at that point. A war broke out right afterwards because of the juxtapositioning of it. People thought there was something more to it. The Chinese used to, 4,000 years ago, kill astronomers in their court that hadn't warned them of this. And yet I was talking to a NASA guy yesterday who said that they had predicted, they had calculated where totality would occur and how much. Back in the 1800s, more than a century ago, this is Newtonian physics at work. It would scare you to see the mathematics involved in figuring out where the track of this was going to go. But this is science, pure science at its best. I mean, to be able to predict with such precision to within a fraction of a second where you're going to get totality in a relatively narrow ribbon across the planet. And, it really is a fascinating exercise in physics and science.
Yeah.
Thank God for the scientists.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Right. Well, every time I do anything, mm-hmm. I thank God for the scientists. Mm-hmm. When I depress the brakes in my car, when I go to the doctor.
When you log on to your computer or iPhone.
Yes,
computer.
Exactly. When I'm thankful for pesticides, when I'm eating my food, I'm thankful for a lot of things that a lot of people are already like, I'm not quite sure. You know, it was interesting. Did you see the they did have a shot of the president at the White House mm-hmm. today watching this thing. And that was out of the ribbon of totality. I mean, I know you're down there watching this, but it was not dissimilar from the way it was here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. About, they were a little less. We were at 87% and they were like at 80-something percent in Washington. But he was out there with Melania and the president were looking up at the thing wearing the glasses. And their young son was with them. He didn't have the glasses on.
He didn't even have them?
And he was like looking away. And I'm like, get him the glasses! Get him the glasses!
That kid needs glasses.
That's a commodity. You can't find him everywhere.
I had already blinded myself. So I was very worried about him at that moment. I'm like, get him a goal! Come on!
Can't save yourself.
The president then took off his glasses after the thing passed. He handed him over to the... to poor Barron, right? And Barron, Barron puts him on. He's looking around. Looks like, oh, yeah, there it is. Like, thank God he's got the glasses.
Well, the trending photo is of the president looking directly at the sun, his face clearly, like, enlightened. Like, you can see the light on his face, and he's pointing at the sun without the glasses.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
But he did put him on for part of it.
I think it reached across political parties, ideologies, religions, place of origin. It's just one of those really, really cool things that nature does every now and then.
Yeah.
You realize that the statistic is that every spot on Earth will only see a total eclipse, what we saw here this afternoon, once every 360 years. So this means you can literally go whole generations without having anything like this occur anywhere near you. You can travel to it, but this is not a particularly common thing. And so it was really worth the time and effort. And surprisingly moving.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, well, you know what? I'm very happy for you because you could tell that this is a lifetime kind of event. And the millions of people who are watching you on television got to experience it through your emotional prism, which was really something special for everybody watching today.
It was.
Well, that's like, guys, I'll tell you one thing. I didn't intend to do it. It kind of overwhelms you. But I'll tell you, it was honest, and to take it for what it's worth, maybe you'll look at it and say, for gosh sakes, but I don't think anybody could look at that and not say, hey, this is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. It really was. But anyway, it's so good to talk to you guys about this. We've been so busy down here because we're trying to feed multiple broadcasts and cut packages and talk to people and incorporate scientists and all that. We had Adler Planetarium folks down here, and they were wonderful. They did such a great job of, we saw all the networks were set up down here and outside the football stadium at SIU. And this is a beautiful area down here. A lot of Illinoisans might be really surprised at how pretty this rolling hills, greenery. I mean, these beautiful lakes down here.
Yeah.
This is a gorgeous part of the state. Yeah. It really is.
Oh, yeah. It's very special. But as people on 57 right now are realizing, it's very sparse.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of distance between the exits and the gas stations.
Yeah.
So there's a little something to think about right there.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Thanks for taking time
Bro,
today.
Good to talk to you. Yeah, good to talk to you guys. And Kevin and Violetta, take care of y'all.
Bye. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom. All right.
Bye, guys.
All right. There goes Tom. We'll talk to him in a couple weeks. He's got other things he's going to have to go do now.
Super emotional, you know.
Brocon Show with Anna DeBlantis right here, 720 WGN. Adam Hoge is standing by with us right now. He's got,
Bears camp. It's all the count right now. It's Bears camp. Bears. Bear down. Chicago.
Adam, did Coach Fox talk about the solar eclipse at all? That's what I want to know.
He actually did. Someone gave him glasses. The eclipse glasses to put on, and he didn't know. He's like, how do these work?
He's got them upside down.
He's like, hold on. I can't see anything out of these things.
Yeah, right.
What's the point of this?
He said a lot of people when they put them on.
You got to look up, Coach. You got to look at the sun.
I don't like to look up.
He likes to look down.
I look down. I look down a lot. Because when I look up, I see everybody else in the NFC North.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Saturday night's performance here. It was a fun game. You know, I very rarely have ever cared about the outcome of a preseason game, but they seem to be playing. And, you know, the Arizona Cardinals, they got a good defense. It's a good football team. They stayed with them. I know it's preseason, but there was a moment where the teams were really playing each other, even in the fourth quarter, where they really, you know, it seemed like the coaches wanted to win that game.
I said that to somebody at halftime in the press box that well, that was a little different. That was actually kind of an entertaining half of football. Mm-hmm. I used to see that the last couple of years. They look competitive. And you know what? I think it's one of the many, many reasons why this goes back to the quarterback position, because I got to be honest, the defense looked pretty good in the first half. And by the way, they weren't 100% healthy. Nick wasn't playing.
They looked actually, I got it. You know, we're not talking about the defense right now. I just want to stop you on that point for a second. We're not talking about the defense, and we should be. Because they did that. There are some guys, there are some standouts on that line. The secondary, there was a sick bat down by this guy. Who they just picked up? They just picked up a defensive back. Help me out here.
Who they drafted?
Was it Marcus Cooper? The draft pick, Eddie Jackson. Oh, yeah, I know what player you're talking about. Eddie Jackson, the fourth round pick, almost one-handed interception in the end zone.
Yes. I mean, these guys actually, you know, they want to build on the secondary. It is interesting to me, as much fun as I make of this particular regime of the Chicago Bears, they did seem to, they've attempted to address every single issue.
Yep. And I got to say, Kevin White may or may not pan out. It's not looking great, I'll be honest. And that was Ryan Pace's first ever draft pick. However, if I'm a Bears fan, I'm pretty happy with what he's done in the draft. As we kind of zoom out here, it's been three drafts now, and you saw that in the first half in Arizona. You saw Leonard Floyd, last year's first round pick. He looked good. Eddie Goldman, I think if he can really play 16 games, he's their nose tackle, second round pick from a couple years ago. If he can play 16 games, I think he has a chance to go to the Pro Bowl. I think he's that impactful on the defensive line. And then Jonathan Bullard kind of took a year to have to switch positions and bulk up and get used to this defense and different technique that he's playing. He looked great in that first half the other night. He's your third-round pick from last year. So these are young defensive players who actually look like legitimate players if they can stay healthy.
Yeah. Coach John Fox says today that they haven't even really talked about or thought about whether or not Mitch Trubisky will play with the first stringers in their upcoming preseason game, which is crazy talk, because we all know they're talking about it.
Yeah.
And so I guess
we know we're talking about it. I don't know. They know they're talking about it.
Their flight home from Arizona, I'm sure they were talking. But so, Adam, what do you think they're going to do, and what do you think they should do in regard to that? Mitch Trubisky deserves to get some reps with the first teamers. Am I wrong?
Yeah, and this is why I wrote immediately following the game the other night on WGNRadio.com is, this needs to be a competition. Come on. I'm not saying Trubisky should be named the starter right away. Some people believe that. Maybe he deserves it. But he needs a better – he needs a fair shot at it. I didn't think it was fair to Trubisky the other night, what he was playing with. The offensive line did not play well in front of him. He had two dangerous shots, one to his head and one to his legs that could have been devastating. And that's got to scare the Bears a little bit. And the running game completely disappeared with the way that offensive line was playing when he was out there. So he was playing with no protection. He was playing with no running game. And that's a scary position to be if you're a quarterback.
You should get used to that, by the way.
That's a common feeling.
Lennon had that in the first half. Tariq Cohen looked great. The protection wasn't phenomenal, but it was good enough.
Let me ask you a question, though. Why was his protection so much better in game one than it was in game two? With essentially the same personnel.
Yeah, there was one big change, and Hronis Grasua was playing center, and Cody Whitehair moved to left guard. So maybe that was a reason. I thought Hronis Grasua played okay, but he did allow pressure a couple times. But I think part of it, too, is Lennon can't move around back there either. So, you know, if he doesn't have perfect protection, it hurts him more than it hurts Mitch Trubisky. I just think everyone has to be curious what Trubisky would look like with better play in front of him, playing with starters, playing with better wide receivers, having an actual running game. And not only that, what does it look like against the other team starters? Because if he doesn't play with the first team this Sunday against Tennessee, you're not going to see that until the games matter. This is really your last chance to experiment with that in the preseason. And I think that he deserves it.
Do you think there's any danger? I mean, he seems to be a player. First of all, it's exciting to watch. He's got the fundamentals, the intangibles. You get a hope for the Bears' future when you see this guy. But is there a danger in not being patient with him developing?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think that's probably what they were worried about when they drafted him, and why they set the table for the idea that he might not play in 2017, because he did play in a drastically different offense in North Carolina, and he only played 13 games. Well, he only started 13 games there, and he was making a big jump both in terms of the offense he had to pick up and the players he's playing against in the NFL. So I get all that, but you go, he creates his own arc, right? I mean, it's up to him and how he handles all of that and how he plays. And if he looks like he can handle it, then you throw a little bit more at him each week. And I think that's what the Bears are doing. I'm just not sure they're doing it fast enough based on what we've seen in these first two preseason games. And then there's the other thing that really seems like what they're worried about. That's Mike Glennon. They seem more worried about Mike Glennon's confidence than Trubisky's. And sure, you should be worried about that. But John Fox was asked today if giving Trubisky first-team reps would be an affront to Mike Glennon. And he basically said,
yeah,
yes, it would be.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a problem.
What about when you drafted the guy number two overall when you had already promised to stop the Mike Glennon? Like, wasn't that a bigger affront?
Well, you know, I got to jump in here. I got to jump in. We just don't want the guy to feel bad. I think that's more important than him standing. I want to make sure that we don't hurt his feelings.
But that's how it honestly almost looks that way, doesn't it? I mean, the only thing that matters here is the development of Mitch Trubisky. Mike Glennon's probably not even going to be on the Bears next year. Who cares?
Stop that!
I'm sorry.
He's going to hear
sorry.
You.
I'm unveiling your secrets here, Coach Fox.
Well, one of his favorite sayings is it's a performance-based business. He hasn't used that saying with the quarterbacks yet. I'm just wondering why. And last year with Jay Cutler.
Wait. Is this another one of those pearls of wisdom like we learned last week, which was event, response, outcome? Is it sort of like that? This is a pace-based, what did you say?
Based business.
Performance-based
business.
This is how the message
based.
Went when he gave it to the team as well. Went, what was that, coach? What did you say?
Again? Let me look that up on my phone.
Performance-based business. So, in other words, the better you are, the faster your career grows. Is that it?
The better you perform, the better
off. Wait, I don't understand what it means.
It's just that when you play well, you get the time on the field, right? But apparently,
so that's what that means.
Yes.
Okay.
It's pretty standard in athletics.
I think so. I don't know. I mean, it seems like one of those obvious things, sort of like event, response, outcome. Like if there's an event and you respond to it, your response could change the outcome.
Sure.
right?
It can.
No, really?
I've seen that.
Like, there's traffic moving on the street. If you walk into it, you'll get hit. If you don't, that's your response. Or if you stay, the outcome will be different. That's correct, yes.
Changes the outcome.
Yeah, that was very good. It's very good. Hey, I just want to make sure you people understand that.
Crystal clear,
Another
coach.
Important thing to do here is when you got to breathe in and then breathe out. It's important to breathe out before you breathe in again. Call it content. All right, practice is over.
Don't all coaches talk like that?
I don't know.
Got a little bit
football
of that.
Talk.
Yeah, football.
Middle school coaches, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know about the rest of the world. All right, let's talk about let's talk a little bit about the kicker controversy. I got to get to this. Yeah. I know we're right up on it right here, so I got about 30 seconds left. But you know, this kid is a Aguayo kid from Florida State who played in Tampa. His first attempt at a field goal was comical. It was almost like a Disney film from the 50s. He kicks the ball, it headed right toward about 20 yards, and then it turns totally right. To a 90-degree right turn. You're like, how'd it do that? There's something bad has happened to that young man.
He managed to hook and slice it on the same kick. It's amazing. Do you remember that game in 2005, the windy game at Soldier Field between the Bears and the 49ers, when Robbie Gould hit a kick that looked like it was going dead straight, and then all of a sudden it took a 90-degree turn right? Okay.
This is an indoor stadium, though.
There was an indoor stadium with
controlled environment
the other day.
Yeah.
I don't know how he did that.
Yeah. I don't think he makes the team. I'm going to guess that kick alone keeps him from making the team.
He had a good run.
Yeah, it was all right.
Yeah, and DeSean Jackson got caught on Instagram. He's down in Tampa now. He got caught. The players were making fun of Aguayo. it might be on Hard Knocks Tuesday, but apparently there's something on the screen making fun of Roberto Aguayo after he'd already been cut. Which is probably a cheap shot, but it just goes to show you that not many guys have confidence in him right now.
Yeah, I think that's the case. All right, thank you very much. You remember, everything you do, people are listening. We're on the radio. Thank you, Coach. Thank you.
It's great advice.
All right, Adam, we'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis right here on 720 WGN. All right, coming up on the program, maybe Stoddard's going to join us.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about an interesting announcement tonight by the President of the United States. He's going to take to national television in prime time to discuss the strategy for Afghanistan moving forward. So we'll find out about that. And then tomorrow, he's going to be in Phoenix tomorrow night, and he's going to be making a stadium stop there, you know, one of the stadium kind of tour, campaign-esque tours. And there's a lot of speculation about what he's going to say while he's there. Is he going to pardon Joe Arpaio, the former Maricopa County sheriff, who was
quite
convicted on
move,
federal charges of, you know, minor charge ultimately because it's a contempt charge, but he was convicted of it after he fought it in court. And so we'll see what happens there. All that coming around. All right. You know what it is indeed time for.
We do. It's that time.
It's the Top 5 at 5 on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis. Brought to you by Builder Supply Outlet. True outlet prices every day. Now home of the Edge Kitchen and Bath Showroom.
It's the Top 5 on the Rokan Show. Let's go.
Oh, yeah. And right now, caller number 19 at 312-981-7200 gets a $50 gift certificate from our friends at Builder Supply Outlet. True outlet prices every day. Check out the Edge, your state-of-the-art kitchen and bath showroom in Broadview. Also open in Orland Park. Woohoo!
Yay!
All right. So, that means checking in at
number 5.
Civil rights activist and comedian Dick Gregory has died. Gregory made a name for himself in the early 1960s as a wry observationist. Jokes about racism in America. He became one of the first African-American comedians to cross over and appeal to both black and white audiences.
None of that. We black folks need to pool our money together and open us up some black greeting card companies. Now, I'm not saying Hallmark. Hallmark is pretty. Hallmark got some stuff. I mean, Hallmark got some stuff that is so beautiful on them cards, make you just want to buy 90 million of them. but it's the message just don't have that ghetto vibration. Open up a Hallmark, the crow's arc sings as sweetly as the lark. Do you love me or not? All I need is just some simple cards with a simple vibration. I ain't gonna do it no more. Give me another chance, baby. I know what you're thinking, but she hit on me first.
Oh, amazing.
He actually, you know, after having this run in comedy, decided he wanted to go into politics. He ran for mayor in Chicago unsuccessfully in 1966 and for president of the United States in 1968. That's sort of the Willie Wilson arc, right? He ran for mayor here, then he ran for president. Neither really worked out.
I thought the whole world knew the first thing I would do after becoming president of the United States is paint the White House black. The second thing I would do would be to bring all the boys home from Vietnam and send LBJ. And I'd have Eartha Kitt call him up every morning and say, "We working on peace feelers, baby."
Yeah, satire with a point. You know, it's amazing you go back and you listen to how ahead of his time he was with some of his commentary.
He also, this is a little known fact about Dick Gregory. He appears on the Give Peace a Chance recording that John Lennon did in the Montreal hotel room where he and Yoko Ono were staging their Bet In for Peace. Everybody talks about swag. Swag is a swag. Swag is a swag. Swag is a swag. This is a bad. In the middle. All we are saying is give peace a chance. Dick Gregory was 84. Checking in at
number four.
Large protests planned when President Trump holds a campaign-style rally in Phoenix tomorrow night. In a Washington Post editorial, Mayor Greg Stanton of Phoenix asks the president to delay the trip, saying that Trump has doused racial tensions with gasoline. Mayor Stanton also writes that the possible pardon of Maricopa County, former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, would be, quote, an endorsement of the lawlessness and discrimination that terrorized Phoenix Latino community.
I did not feel it was the right time to do it. It was too close after Charlottesville. That was such a difficult situation, not only for the people in Charlottesville, but for all Americans. And so the campaign style rally so shortly thereafter, I did not think was appropriate.
Wow. This ought to be interesting tomorrow night.
Yeah, it will be. I mean, I think just the security around it, it'll be contentious no matter what. You can only imagine the protests because of what a controversial move that would be to pardon the sheriff.
My sense is that tonight's speech is going to be very much on the teleprompter. It's going to be, I'm guessing. I mean, I'm like everybody else right now, including his own staff. They're just guessing on what's going to happen. But I would imagine that tonight is going to be very, very performance. In front of a military audience, he's actually not doing it from the White House, which is unusual. Because he's going out, generally a primetime speech is done from either the Oval Office or some other part of the White House. Now, I know that there has been some construction of the White House, and I don't think that was scheduled to be done until next week. So I don't know if
that
is one of the reasons. It may be a factor. So I want to be fair about that. He is going to Fort Myer, which is not too far from the White House, but he is going to have an audience of military personnel. And this is kind of an interesting situation because you've seen this. In the past, he wants to get amped up and, you know, he wants a crowd reaction. When he's in front of a crowd, he does not want a silent crowd. So he will say things to try to get them to react. Now, one of the other issues there is if they do react directly to whatever he's saying, especially controversial stuff, then there's backlash for that, especially if they're caught on camera doing it like for those law enforcement officers who reacted by, you know, laughing or cheering at the at the fact, you know, when he was suggesting that
the way you treat someone is you're loading them into the
suspects.
Squad car.
Yeah.
And yeah, it didn't come across well to a lot of people.
So he's using some stagecraft here, using the military as part of the stagecraft, which he's not the first president to do that.
No.
So I'm not going to criticize him for that, but I'm going to say it'll be some interesting television tonight, but tomorrow night is really going to be something because he's going to be off the prompter tomorrow night.
It will be. I think today will even be interesting. I mean, is he going, as he was critical of the Afghanistan policy and what we've done in Afghanistan over the years, is he going to boost the number of troops and then, you know, moving forward? What is the strategy?
All right. Well, just as we're saying, breaking news, Fox News is reporting that the president has approved sending 4,000 more troops to Afghanistan, according to senior officials.
It's, well, they're saying that civilian casualties are up some of the highest numbers they've been throughout the war. So it seems as if the policies are not necessarily effective. And there you go. We'll see what else he says.
Top 5-5 continues right here on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis on your 720 WGN. Checking in at
number 3. Now I have
the time of my life. 30 years ago, Dirty Dancing premiered. So it means it's 30 years since moviegoers were impressed with the stellar dance moves of Jennifer Grey, the original Jennifer Grey. She was replaced by a cyborg years later.
Doesn't look the same.
Didn't look anything like her. She was replaced by her own wax figure. You know how the wax figure never looks like the original actor?
Yeah, it's always slightly, something's wrong. Something's slightly different.
That's what happened there. And Patrick Swayze. The late, great Patrick Swayze.
Mm.
Now, you'll recall the movie follows Francis Baby Houseman, played by Jennifer Grey, the original, and she visits an upstate New York resort where her family, of course, and now she falls in love with Swayze's Johnny Castle.
That's a great name, isn't it? I forgot that was his name in the movie, Johnny Castle.
The camp's beloved dance instructor, bad boy reputation.
Oh, yeah.
Although the film grossed $150 million worldwide, it was a bona fide hit. The dancing was the star of the show.
You are not scared of anything. I don't
know. I'm scared of everything. I'm scared of what I saw. I'm scared of what I did, of who I am. And most of all, I'm scared of walking out of this room and never feeling the rest of my whole life the way I feel when I'm with you.
You know what's funny?
What?
It's 30 years ago, it grossed $150 million. Yeah, the acting. Yes, that's funny.
It doesn't stand up over time, does
no.
it?
No, well, especially when you don't see it.
Right, that's true.
Yeah. But $150 million is what it made worldwide in its initial release.
Supposed to be a total flop. They said the test audience hated it. It might have gone right to video, and it just became like the momentum behind it that just took off.
But now a middling comedy makes $150 million worldwide.
That's true. But a coming-of-age movie that mostly stars dancing?
Yeah, but she was supposed to be awkward. I think that's why it works.
Mm-hmm.
Her character in general is not cool
right.
in the beginning.
And then she becomes cool
because she lets go
of her princessness and becomes falls in love for the first time, thinks about someone else, not herself.
Right, with the boy who mm-hmm. wasn't supposed to fall in love with.
Exactly.
Teaches her more about
it's
herself.
It's a great lesson for girls.
Yeah. Fall in love with the dancer, the
classic
exotic dancer.
Storyline.
You won't be anything until you fall in love for the first time.
When you're at a bachelorette party, just like try to fall in love with the dancer, the one who comes and dances for you.
Yes, that's right.
Change your life.
Isn't that what everybody tells? What all the fathers tell their daughters?
No, they don't tell them.
No, they don't.
It worked for them.
It worked. Right.
It did.
So it was
very
a
well.
Summertime romantic dance movie. And what else did it have to compete with? Footloose, right? I mean, what else was it competing with? All right, and finally.
Number one.
No.
That's wrong?
No, that's wrong.
We're not on number one?
No, we're not.
Number two.
Don't skip ahead. Thank you, Orion.
Thank you. Today's eclipse was a Super Bowl of sorts for Tom Skilling, our own meteorologist here at WGN.
Such a beautiful moment watching him. I had tears with him. I just got choked up watching him.
He had not seen a solar eclipse ever in his life. And here's a man who's literally lived for the weather.
Mm-hmm.
And he has made Chicagoans care about the weather and understand the weather more than probably any other human in the history of Chicago television, maybe
sure.
in the history of all of American television. Mm-hmm. That is for sure. As a matter of fact, Tom Skilling... The words Tom Skilling started trending on Twitter.
I saw that.
Today,
it still actually is right now.
With many praising him for his coverage as well as his incredible, honest reaction.
Yep.
totally couldn't.
Oh, look at that. Look at that. Oh, my word. Wow. This is amazing. What do you think of this, guys?
Here, buddy.
Wow.
You did it. Congratulations. Where are you going to be in 7 years?
I don't know. I think we're going to be back here again.
All right, so we'll see you back here.
Look at this.
Channel 9 said the only thing better than watching the eclipse was watching Tom Skilling watching the eclipse. And I agree with it. It was such an honest moment, wasn't it? And to see a guy who's like come close to tornadoes and all kinds of weather phenomena to get this moved, you know, by the eclipse. It was cool to watch.
Amazing.
It really was.
Amazing stuff. All right, and finally.
Number one.
Jerry Lewis, the high prince of lowbrow comedy, has died. The son of vaudeville entertainers, he became a star in the early 1950s as Martin's spastic sidekick in nightclubs on television and in 16 movies.
What are you laughing at?
Say, what kind of a voice do you have?
Until I was 18, I was a soprano.
Soprano?
Yeah, but then my mother told me I was born a boy.
Don't tell me you were born.
What do you think, I came from an egg?
No, the chicken would have buried it.
Uh-huh. Well, my mother loves me.
I bet she was disappointed. I bet she wanted a child.
Well, she got one. Look up the records. I was born at the Mercy Hospital.
What's the matter? Were you sick?
No, I want to be near my mother.
Actually, when you go back and you watch those Dean and Jerry movies,
mm-hmm.
they're actually very comfortable to watch. Mm-hmm. They're beautifully done, beautifully shot, goofy. I mean, if you think Dirty Dancing doesn't really hold up, it's like, hey, that wouldn't really happen. That's, you know, very true of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis comedies. But they were very good together.
Is.
They had amazing timing together.
No question.
He starred in more than 45 movies throughout his 5-decade career, and a lot of critics took issue with him. Although, you know what he did do? Hmm. I should mention this. He also invented the video playback system.
What?
Yeah. That movies, to this very day, they use. But they didn't. At that point, you'd have to. The director would shoot something. Then they have to wait for the film to get directed to see, developed, to see what it was that they had just shot. And so when he started directing movies, and he did, he directed a number of them, some better than others, mm-hmm. but he sort of famously directed some avant-garde stuff. He wanted to have video playback, so video was becoming more portable at that point, and he basically hooked up to the lens of the camera the ability for the camera to shoot the film, but also to feed a video version of it so he could see the performances that he had just shot mm-hmm. and decide whether or not he wanted to reshoot them.
Seems like an important invention.
They just picked it up from there. So, I mean, things to think about. I mean, Jerry Lewis, I interviewed a number of times over the years for mm-hmm. the telethon.
Yeah.
Not exactly the easiest guy to interview.
Now, why is that? Was he frosty?
He's just kind of frosty. And he was, you know, he would do 100 of those kinds of interviews to promote. And it would be 5 minutes. He's
right,
do
done. Thing.
You catch him at a good moment, he was funny. You catch him in a bad moment. But he was an utter professional. True. I mean, that was the thing. He'd seen everything that you could possibly see in show business. And at one point, when he did The Nutty Professor, the original Nutty Professor, mm-hmm. there, by the way, Violetta and Kevin, there was a movie called The Nutty Professor.
Okay.
Before. There was an original version of that starring Jerry Lewis.
Love that movie.
Yes, it was.
Probably a different version.
Yes, the different, yeah. The one that came out with 30 years
after. It wasn't Eddie. Eddie Murphy was not the original Nutty Professor.
Was it something I said?
You must be deranged.
Yeah, if you don't believe in idle chatter and a lot of small talk, yeah, I'm deranged. Or would you prefer that I conduct myself like the little boys you're accustomed to dating? Now, you know darn well that nothing delights us more than being enjoyed, appreciated, or just plain liked by someone, right? Well, you're not going to tell me that you're here with me now because I don't appeal to you. And I'm sure that you can see I dig you pretty good, too, right? Well, isn't it easier to say so? Or would you much prefer that I used a lot of that phony dialogue I'm sure you've heard at least a half a dozen times before? So you see, Stell, when I tell you that you're a vibrant, beautiful, exciting woman. You can believe me.
Yeah, a little different, wasn't it? It's sort of a darker version. It was kind of rapey, actually, his version of the professor. You know?
And not only that, was he just reading from the script?
Why, you didn't like that delivery?
No.
Yeah, he was just reading, because you don't even, mm-hmm. you sort of lose him in the dialogue, like, wait, what is he saying? Because he's not actually interpreting the dialogue, he's just, you know, directly, your point, Judy, directly reading from the script.
I'm going to go back and watch that one.
Yeah.
No, don't bother.
Okay, I'm good.
The new one's better.
The Eddie Murphy
version. The Eddie Murphy version is better, actually. Very rarely are they
very
that true,
rarely.
But you know, it spawned its own sequels, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that The Nutty Professor, was a little different. This is a little different. Because that, actually playing that, and I don't want to, because, you know, Jerry Lewis had an amazing career, and
no,
we should
question.
Honor his career here. But
the
playing
epitome of a performer.
Correct. But playing that clip does not really sell it.
It doesn't do it for him. It doesn't really
but,
sum
you know,
up his body
you'd
of work.
Hard find, it'd be hard to find a clip that would, really. I mean,
true.
As far as an actor, you know.
Right. And then you think about
what he
was just, did.
Yeah, he was like a slapstick silly guy.
Judy, just confirm you're not a Jerry Lewis fan.
No,
no,
not really. And I think that's either you love him or you hate him. I don't hate him. I just, no, I never got it.
Well, he did raise over $1 billion.
Yes, and I love him for that.
MDI.
I always watch the telethons, but not his movies.
Jerry Seinfeld said, if you don't get Jerry Lewis, you don't understand comedy. And that's a pretty strong comment from him, I think.
Well, one of the things about Jerry Lewis, though, is especially in his later years when he'd sit there, after he'd raised about $750 million trying to get to the billion mark,
gosh,
he wouldn't sleep. He'd get rather obnoxious during the telethon itself.
I mean,
he'd be ordering everybody
that's
around.
That's hard. We're live television for that many hours. There's going to be a few moments.
Poor Ed McMahon would be. Ed McMahon right now is trying to outrun him in heaven, is what he's trying to do.
Here he comes.
Don't tell Jerry I'm here. That's basically what's happening. Rokan Show with Anna DeBlancis right here on 720 WGN Chicago. And A.B. Stoddard joins us from Real Clear Politics. Big night for the president this evening, A.B. He's going to make a nationally televised address, although he's choosing to do this. And we were speculating about this earlier. Perhaps you know the answer. He's going to do this from Fort Myer, which is an army post not too far from the White House. He's not doing it from the White House. In front of assembled soldiers and other Army personnel, I'm assuming. Do we know why he's choosing that location as opposed to doing it from the Oval Office or, you know, some other kind of White House setting?
Well, it's interesting. I think it actually helps to be surrounded by members of the armed forces, and they'll be, you know, polite, respectful, and applaud and that kind of thing. And I think it probably helps him more, you know, symbolically play the commander-in-chief, you know, role, and there he is, and he's going to be on teleprompter and probably give a very well-written, focused address, and it might be better than the Oval Office setting, and I think, as I recall, that President Obama did the same thing, didn't he, in December of 2009, after taking all these months to come up with his Afghanistan plan. He didn't do it from the Oval Office. And it just might be that that Trump is just not really comfortable with that. It might the Oval Office address, I think, sometimes gives more of a feel of an emergency,
mm-hmm.
and he might not be. It might make him uncomfortable. But I'm not entirely sure of that. I'm just guessing. And I think that the setting that they chose is good.
AB, we talk about the content of the speech. It's come out that the president will likely call for an increase to boost troop levels there. Fox is reporting 4,000 potentially would be going to the Afghanistan area. But what anything else about the content of his speech that we know that you might talk about what he'll say?
Well, I mean, I think we are not going to be surprised by those numbers, right? Or that the fact that they're inching upward and not downward, and that it's a place that American presidents are, you know, afraid to leave now, and afraid to, you know, give away to the Russian-influenced Taliban or anything like this, right? So, I just think that it's really how much accountability and sort of leadership he shows and how little blame casting he engages in, I think will really be the most important thing, right? It'll be the tone of how much he's taking on this terrible burden that he absolutely inherited. But he has to embrace it. And that was a criticism Republicans made of President Obama all the time. Why triple down in Afghanistan and ask the American people, you know, to engage in this, to dig deeper into this fight without ever talking about it? You know, and they always compared him to President George W. Bush and said he wasn't making the case for the blood and treasure to the American people. And so if Trump tries to sort of lay it down but run away, I think that's a mistake. I mean, I don't think he needs to be, you know, bellicose and pretend it's a solution, but I think he needs to be accountable and you know, come make people feel that he owns it and he's confident in it. Because we know, if you've been paying attention to this debate, there have been some very stormy scenes where he is furious about the fact that we haven't won and it's unsolvable and it's intractable. And obviously, to increase a troop presence there is really going back on the rhetoric of, and on promises of his campaign. So it's, I think we're not really, we're looking for, you know, what is his tone? What is his leadership voice tonight as he makes the announcement?
Well, I know this was scheduled in advance of this, but Steve Bannon being out now, this obviously Steve Bannon was one of the voices of get out of Afghanistan. As a matter of fact, in some of the clips that you're seeing today from right before the election in 2016, Trump made a prompter speech about Afghanistan and talked about how, you know, they hate us over there and we could have rebuilt the United States three times over with the money that we spent there, and we need to get out. And that's right out of Bannon's playbook. Now that Bannon is gone, you have to wonder if he does, you know, if he does do what is now being reported by Fox News, he's going to do, which is add more troops and, you know, let's stay the course there. If that in fact does happen, will Bannon and Breitbart start criticizing him for that?
Right. I think we don't know. Maybe Bannon's going to give a little, maybe there's like a little bit of a pause, a friendly pause, or maybe, you know, he kicks in soon. I mean, we just really don't know how much battling Bannon is going to do directly with the president. We know how he feels about the kids, the in-laws, the, you know, Henry H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor. We know how he feels about the National Economic Council head, Gary Cohn. We know how he feels about, you know, basically everyone in the West Wing. Just depends on how long I think we're going to see him wait until he goes directly at the president. Bannon is of the mind that, you know, everyone in the country, because President Trump won, is a nationalist, America first, you know, pull out of, you know, the Middle East voter. And that's actually not the case. And so while he's been fueling Trump's temptation to just play to the base with Twitter fights and bashing Republican leaders in Congress and all this stuff, I think that, you know, it's clear that the generals have prevailed upon Trump and scared him that if he pulls out now, the wreckage will be on him, and a burgeoning terrorist threat will be his responsibility and his legacy. And so, you know, he is backing off one more thing that Bannon believed, you know, was a promise to the voters. But we're just not entirely certain if that's 30% of the country, 35% of the country, or 28% of the country. And there's this, as we know, with all of these debates and discussions, right, whether it's let's go after legal immigration, the Paris Climate Accord, you know, tax cuts for the wealthy, how much of a safety net in health care reform his voters need. There's this constant divide between what Trump and Bannon see as the mandate of the lack of mandate victory he had versus, you know, what the responsibility of a president to come in and actually wake up every morning thinking about the voters he didn't win over and the fact that he has to lead the entire country. And that's a big debate that has really sort of riven this wing from day one.
Good luck to you on that. He doesn't seem to be interested in wooing voters.
He doesn't seem so far.
I think the other way, have you noticed he doesn't even go to states he didn't win? I mean, it's sort of like, you know, it's the 307. He knows that if he's going to do this again, he's just thinking about how is he going to win again, because that will be his legacy. He wants to be a two-term president. Doesn't want to be a one-term president, because they're generally seen as failed presidencies, or at least in the modern era, they're seen as that. And so he wants to win. And so he's going to keep up that strategy. He's going to work for the next 3.5 years, essentially, to be 3 years and a couple of months to be as focused as he can on those 307 electoral votes, right? And maybe more.
Right,
and,
but,
you know,
I mean,
build
on do you ever win? Do you ever win a second term if you don't win over some of the voters?
No, no, because you lose.
The thing is, if we wake up on Wednesday morning and he's gone to Arizona and he's bashed Senator McCain and Senator Flake and pardoned Sheriff Joe Arpaio and had like a total meltdown, you know, divisive rally where he's, you know, going to fight every last person, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell. Well, then, you know, we're back at right. We're back at square one where, you know, no one's going to listen to what he says in Afghanistan. He can't unite the country no matter what he says about Charlottesville, even a week later, or a month later, no one's going to listen. But if he goes there tomorrow night and all of a sudden, you know, talks in a unifying way, then we know that something happened in a solar eclipse when he looked up at the sky.
And pointed at it.
Right. I wanted his son to have the glasses, too.
I know. Give it to your kid.
Three people out there and two sets of glasses.
He's 11 years old.
I was very worried about the son. I kept going, Baron, please. Because, you know, when you're 11, like, the temptation is to not believe your parents.
Well, right. Especially when you say, tell a kid, don't look anywhere. It's like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Exactly. Don't look at that.
Hey,
okay.
Don't look over there. Don't look there. Don't look up. And they do.
If you heard the conversations I had today with my 14-year-old daughter about whether you can use the selfie mode on the cell phone, if that's going to hurt your retina, it went on and on.
I did too with my daughter.
I want to go back to Arizona here because I think you're making a really excellent point, too, because tomorrow night it's basically part of the stadium tour. It's the summer tour. It's probably the last show of the summer tour for Donald Trump. And the thing is that, you know, when you for all the reporters who've covered these rallies, and there was sort of an infamous one here in Chicago during the election at the University of Illinois Chicago campus. And there was a woman who stood outside, remember, and she gave the Nazi salute, and she was on the front page of all these newspapers. Mm-hmm. And then she basically explained it by saying, well, she was responding to the you know, to leftists who were prompting her, and so she gave it to them just to say, you know, we don't want, you know, it was a long and sort of complicated explanation, but my point is that those rallies, and people who've covered them know that there are a lot of white nationalists who tend to either get into the rally or be on the periphery of the rally. That is a bit of a rallying point for some of those folks. You do wonder if the White House should be concerned that there are going to be some of those folks there, neo-Nazis or nationalists or whatever it is, who, you know, and they may be totally peaceful, and mm-hmm. but they're still gonna be there. And there, and I would imagine, my guess is that's going to be covered by reporters who are there. And when it is it going to take away from the, is it, you know, going to sort of perpetuate this narrative that the president, you know, is, especially if he does all the things you just said?
You know, this is really interesting. If you look at the reporting out of Politico today and Maggie Haberman, the New York Times and others, they've made clear that people in his circle are freaked out about mm-hmm. this rally. Mm-hmm. That the timing, just that you know, there's people on Twitter today reporting that these bikers are going to come in to protect Trump supporters. Like, there are definitely people agitating for some confrontation tomorrow night. And yikes. And it even if they're not white nationalists, it could get bad. The governor is not going to come, you know, as you've read. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, it's bad when people around Trump who really want him to succeed and want, you know, things to go as smoothly as possible for him are nervous about tomorrow night. And that's why I think we just don't know. I think probably till the 11th hour, they're going to be saying, be nice, don't talk about Mitch McConnell, please be nice, you know, because they want it to, they can't really cancel now, but they just don't want it to be a huge conflagration of divisive rhetoric. That is another news story that separates him from congressional Republicans for another, you know, 3 weeks. Also, with stuff going on outside the stadium, I just thought that was stunning when I read that people, you know, his advisors are nervous about this idea.
Well, the optics, no matter what happens here, there's going to be those people. Even if the president gets up on the stage and decries them, they're still going to be there. He won't. But if he did, there's got to be somebody who's saying to him, you know what you should do here? Let's throw everybody for a loop here and say some things that are healing and trying to bring people together. Let's show them you can do that.
Boy,
and
that'd be great.
That's what I mean. I think he still has the option. And if the solar eclipse gave him some positive vibes, I'm thinking he could go there tomorrow night and say, yeah. I gave this address in Afghanistan. This is really tough, but as a nation, we have to be invested. We have to be in it together. We have all these things coming up in September. Let's move on. We have all these legislative fights. We've got to come together. Not mention Jeff Flake. And just carry on.
Got
and it.
It
would surprise people, but it would be, look, it would really actually be a reset because he's graded on a curve, as we
yeah.
all know. And I think that that would be the right thing to do. It's just you know, what are the odds, right, that
yeah.
he wants to reset?
Very, very low.
And he doesn't want to fight Jeff Flake.
Yeah, very low. And we're very optimistic. All right, thank you very much, AB. We'll talk to you soon. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
AB Stoddard, Real Clear Politics. Rokan Show with Anna DeBlanchis right here, 720 WGN, congratulating everybody on Earth for surviving the eclipse.
No big deal. We survived.
You made it.
Was that today?
Eclipse apocalypse. Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
Eclipse-less? It's an eclipse-less is what it was.
Did you see that people were buying shelf-stable food with a 30-year shelf life, and they were being sold in buckets, and they had freeze-dried food? And
that explains a lot, doesn't it?
Televangelist Jerry Falwell, I think, was Jim Baker.
Jim
Baker was selling it to his followers.
No,
buckets of food.
No,
yes,
a televangelist,
he was.
Jim Baker, who basically went to jail for defrauding his followers before.
Still owes $6 million in back taxes if you're counting.
Then decided to use the eclipse as a way to make more money by selling them buckets of food at a 5-time markup?
Absolutely correct.
I am shocked to hear
Bingo.
This.
Bingo. You could get your bucket of Italian variety survival food.
Italian variety. Well,
they
nice.
Have it. They go Italian, turns out. A 20-year survival food bucket costs you about $350 to $450.
What comes in that bucket? You get some salami, some aged cheese or something?
No, pizza, breadsticks, Italiano marinara, the fettuccine Alfredo, mac and cheese. One of the reporters who tried to serve it all up said it smelled a little bit like dog food. Just a little. It reminded him of that.
The dog food will remind you of the suffering that happened with Jesus.
Yeah, yes. Great. So, thank you very much, Jim Baker.
Marinara tasted a little better than it smelled, so there was a lingering chemical aftertaste. But if you get past that in your underground bunker, I think you're
so. Now, what happened? Now, how disappointed are these people that the world didn't come to an end? No one thought that was going to happen, by the way, except for Jim Baker and the idiots who bought his poor saps. Somewhere between idiot and poor sap, I'm not quite sure where.
Yeah, that was
who bought his freeze dried contents.
Yeah, freeze-dried beef chunks also available in the 16-ounce serving, $70. There you go. You can get your cheese powder too. That was
cheese
available.
Powder, right? In case you need that.
And then you can get your solar power generator because you might need that.
Right, for the apocalypse. It was an eclipse that
right.
You know
there's
happens
not gonna be a different. Sun.
It happens fairly regularly, actually. If you want to know the truth, somewhere on Earth. You know, every couple of years, there's something.
Right, but how good is something solar powered if we don't have a sun?
That's a good point.
I didn't think of that.
You can make a lot of money, though.
Also, he sounds like an angrier Ted Cruz. You guys notice that?
Kind of does. Well, he's angry. Spent some time in prison. You know, he come out angry.
I did spend time in prison. And I learned the love that only can exist between a man and another man.
Uh-huh. It's kind of scary.
Yeah, that's sinister.
That guy was among the most... I can't. The word doesn't even come
you.
To me. It eclipses me right now because this was right when I started in the business. This guy was like this was a hot deal.
He was the height of the popularity. Like 40 million people were following him at some point in terms of his television shows and you know his Christian TV network.
He was such a charlatan. And then, you know, he got proved to be a charlatan because he was, even though he was all about sin and rage and all these other things, he was doing the horizontal hula with his secretary.
That did happen.
Who was a lot, you know, she was like sort of a Chattanooga 8. And he looked like...
Chattanooga 8.
He had
is that a band?
No. Sort of like she'd be an 8 in Chattanooga.
I know you're
she'd
saying.
She'd be like a 6.5 in New York. I don't know. But she was, but you know, She was something.
But he was the Tammy Faye Baker one, right? Wasn't
yeah,
he
and Tammy Faye, yeah.
And then she's no longer with us, right?
No.
And so now he has a new wife, or relatively, it looks a little bit like Tammy Faye.
Yes.
Just about every way.
You've got to have that if you're a Jim Baker. And he was such a scam artist. And it was so obvious. And he was appearing on Nightline. That used to be a show that was on TV that people watch with Ted Koppel. And he would, you know, he'd be appearing there, and you could tell the guy was totally scamming. And then he would say, and then anytime anybody would criticize him for it, he would say, "That's the devil's work." You know, and you'd be like, "All right, well, okay."
Nightline's still on, by the way, but yes.
Yeah, neighbors. I know. Nobody watches anymore, but it is still on. I sit through it to get to the Windy City Live rerun.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the point is that you've got this guy who was so obvious, but
you
yet.
Would think.
Yes, yet there were all these people who were following him and giving him money and believed in him. And it was like, it's so disconcerting to me mm-hmm. back in the 1980s when this was happening. And then finally the downfall. And then, you know, these people who literally, these little old ladies who were, you know, they just wanted to believe in something, right? Or little old people that just wanted to believe in something. People that had bad tragedy in their lives and needed something. And he was preying on that mm-hmm. and preying on their emotions and their needs. And then boom. He, you know, goes and gets, you know, they find him with a secretary and the whole thing unravels. And remember, he had an air conditioned doghouse for his dog.
Yes, I remember that.
They were
you'd never heard of that before until him.
Right. Because they were buying planes and houses and they were living this incredibly lavish lifestyle. And his wife, you know, had permanently tattooed makeup. It was you know,
right.
She had the eyeliner and the eyelashes that, you know, came out 4 feet. And she was like, you know. It was just a spectacle, and as a young adult at mm-hmm. that point, I couldn't believe that people could be so gullible, and yet they were.
Well, and you think about it. You mentioned little old ladies, and in the taping, they show pictures of it today. The people who were being, you know, basically pitched this is the survival food and the $500 buckets of food and things. A lot of them were little old ladies. They were older women who were there who, you know.
Yeah,
supposedly being pitched, you know, buy these buckets, you're going to need them. Buckets of food.
Oh, my God. He was just such a scam artist. But, you know, the thing is that, you know, there are always people who are going to fall for that. I used to just get angry. I was taking advantage of it. And then at some point in my life and fairly recently
And then
as
you
well,
bought a bucket?
And then I realized people are just, you know, there's you know, a sucker born every minute. And that's the problem is that you get there's people that are no matter what. They just want to believe more than they can see.
Yeah.
And they choose to believe in, you know, it's one thing to believe in faith. It's another thing to believe in false prophets and mm-hmm. people like this dude, or, you know, running around screaming they can do things that you knew that every thinking human being knew that they couldn't do.
Right. Well, linking the eclipse to the end of man.
Right. So he's still at
also
it.
A bit of a stretch.
That's the most amazing thing. And then he's still, Jim Baker is still, here we are 30, I think exactly 30 years later. I think it was 87 when he went down. Or something right. like that. You know what I mean?
Released in 94, so that about makes sense. Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So it was right about
5 years
this.
In prison. Yeah, that's
yeah.
about
so
right.
So this is right about the moment that he mm-hmm. was at 30 years ago, and he's back out there scamming people again.
Yeah. I was wondering, I thought we'd, you know, I really, not that I'm asking for him, but I really thought we would have heard from Creepy Uncle on these issues because there are people who I'm sure did this. They went out and they got the buckets and they bought the freeze-dried foods and the generators. And...
Creepy Uncle's in the hospital.
Oh. Oh, I'm sorry.
Plus, I kind of feel like he wouldn't fall for it. He'd be like, I already got my own bucket.
He's probably already hooked up.
No, he covered his entire head in tinfoil.
Oh.
Because it was a satellite that the U.S. government put up there that was blocking the sun. It wasn't actually the moon. So,
right. So he had
a strong beam coming down on everyone.
As Kevin knows, because Kevin was the one who found him in the basement.
Right. Kevin knows these things.
Unable to breathe.
We have dinner once a week.
He went into a self-imposed coma. and he's now recovering.
Kevin, you had to eat your raviolis by yourself.
He'll be back though.
He had a good run.
He's okay.
He also apparently he overheated his head while he did it.
That happens when you put your head in the microwave. Yeah.
Seen it 100 times with him.
Most people going to the hospital for eye issues. Creepy Uncle burned his head somehow.
So that was, yeah. So we'll
I'm told sure
him.
Yeah,
we'll
I warned him.
We'll hear from him on the other side. Now, speaking of that, I did mention earlier that I saw. I, as much as we have been giving the warnings here, I didn't obey the warnings.
I can't believe you didn't. I'm actually worried. because
I am too.
Well, it doesn't always set in right away, the damage. But
oh, God. Don't tell me that now.
They said like 3 hours. So it does Anna's face, like, is it missing like all?
Do you see my nose? How many fingers?
I can't see. I have no idea. All right. I want to play this. We have the audio. We'll do this on the other side of Violetta's traffic. The audio of the guy who, what is it, 40 years ago?
Oh, gosh. It's
or
chilling.
50 years ago? Lost his eyesight. 3 hours after the eclipse, which would be right about, you know.
And he was a kid, wasn't he, when it happened? Sort of younger, youngish.
Yeah.
I think because he said he was with his friend and they were sort of doing it together.
Yeah, and then the next thing you know.
Yeah.
So in the annals of There's One Born Every Minute, we'll play that for you on the other side.
Wake up and watch the new WGN-TV Early Morning News with Lauren Jiggetts, Dan Ponce, Traffic with Sarah Gindra, and Weather with Morgan Kochmeyer, weekdays 4 a.m. to 6 a.m.
All right, let's play this because this is kind of, for people, I know we should have played this probably last week so people wouldn't look at the eclipse. But now
service.
That people have looked at the eclipse and probably, you know, cheated a little bit because we, you know, famously, you had the, was it Boston College coach who came out and said, do we have audio of him saying this?
No, he talked to a reporter and a reporter tweeted out, it's Coach Steve Adazio, the Boston College head coach.
And what did he say again?
He said, I don't need glasses. And you can check and see if I'm blind tomorrow. Says, he says he's not worried about it, so we'll check in with Coach Adazio tomorrow.
Because he had not heard this particular testimony.
Well, a science teacher said there's a solar eclipse right over here. I can take you to almost to the exact same spot. Who knew I'd be coming back to the same spot all these years later? Oh, 20 seconds probably. That's all it took. I'm glad I didn't go 40 seconds. It would have even been worse. Every time we go to a eye doctor now for an exam, they look, after they dilate your eyes and look in there, the first thing they say is, you looked at a solar eclipse sometime in your life.
God.
Isn't that horrible?
So he's got partial blindness in one eye.
And it was, apparently, it wasn't even a total eclipse where he was. It was partial, you're right, because it was Alaska and Canada was the path. And then that's all it took. He and his buddy, 16 at the time, each looked with one eye, both of them. In different eyes, have the same issue.
Well, partial eclipse would be even worse because it'd be more sun showing.
Right.
Right.
So, at least they were smart to only look through one eye.
Well,
I mean, if you're going to do it, only burn one.
Smart. I'm not sure I'd say smart.
Very smart. Very thoughtful.
But yes.
I'm not quite sure how that worked. It might have been the angle, but they were just looking at it. I don't think it mattered. I don't think
you look with your left eye, and I'll look with my right, and we'll just stick
together. I don't think that was the
conversation
they had. I'll be honest. I think that there was more to it than that.
They said they closed one eye each, and that they each had, you know, basically the same outcome but different eyes.
Oh, God.
And they say it's kind of like when you see a license plate on the news or whatever, and they don't want you to see what the numbers are. They said his is the size of a pea, but it's exactly that. There's like a hazy portion every time he looks at anything.
Yeah, see?
That's giving me a headache just thinking about it.
I know.
Just,
see?
It's scary.
What happened there?
It's scary.
Hold on. I think I got that.
You don't have it. Hopefully you don't.
I don't know.
You burned both eyes. Come on, Ro.
Well, I put my sunglasses. I put my sunglasses on.
Don't help. They were not sunglasses.
They're not ass certified.
That was not the point, Violetta. What I was trying to do. See, what had happened was I was on my little roof patio, and I'm like looking up at the thing, and I'm just trying to get a picture of it. So I look up, and I'm like, and it was hazy, right? It was like cloudy today.
It was cloudy.
So I was looking through the clouds, and I thought, well, I'll look, there's clouds, and I didn't have the glasses, and I thought, well, it was like clear skies, I would have never looked at it, period. But I look through the clouds. Well, you know, I probably have looked at the sun through clouds before and just not noticed it. Except I did notice it when you do look at the cloud, at the sun through the clouds, you notice it.
You do.
It was. So I put my sunglasses on and I was trying to watch through my phone what was going on and try to get a picture.
Directly through your phone?
Turns out your phone doesn't react quite the same way because your phone, you know, phone camera didn't want to close its iris enough to actually get just as a big
starburst.
The phone
was smarter than you, actually.
It's a big,
It's a smartphone.
The phone's like, you know, I'm not going to look
be
at
doing
this.
No. Shouldn't be doing this. So then a couple times I took it down and I looked at it. It was wild to see because it looked like there was a chunk of the sun missing. And now then I would like count to two and think, all right, well, I'm just gonna do that for 2 seconds and then we'll look away.
Why did
now,
you do
I don't
that?
Know because I did. I don't. I mean, it wasn't. Oh. It's not my. my smartest moment.
You're the guy who's on the air telling everybody to get the ass certified glasses. Well, American Astronomical
and I didn't have
Society.
The ass glasses, and we didn't have time to produce the ass hat. But in 7 years, I'm going to have an ass hat produced.
You're going to need one.
Though it's got the hat and the sun and the you know
solar glasses attached to it.
Right. Sure.
With the beer holders on the side and the straws coming down the top.
Exactly. Well, for whatever sort of
drink of
hydration.
Oh, yeah,
you need.
Right. Yeah. Could be a soda.
Hope
vodka.
You understand. Yeah, whatever. Hopefully by then we'll have outgrown vodka, or I'll be dead. One or the other will have happened. But I will certainly have the you know the thing the I will never do this again because my eye feels a little funny.
Yeah. Does it really feel? Yeah. Oh gosh. I'm worried about
it's just
but honestly
head.
You didn't even get the full experience because it's hard to see the effect of it without the glasses, because if you just looked up at the sun for a second you couldn't see, but through the glasses the sun turns orange.
Is that what happened to you when you looked up there?
Yeah.
What did you see?
Yeah, so when you look through the glasses you see the orange, the sun is really orange, mm-hmm. kind of reddish, and then you see just black everywhere else, so you can see the moon covering the
even
sun
through the clouds. You're able to see that here?
No. But when the clouds clear a little bit, you can see it.
Oh, it was kinda awesome.
It was
great today.
It was incredible.
But looking up in a picture even, you would put the glasses up to your to your phone lens, and then it would take a good picture.
I tried that. But that was a mistake, because I had to take my glasses off and put them over the phone lens and then look up there to see where I was aiming. So that didn't work out so great.
No.
I put my head down and I put the the lens in front of my phone and just took maybe 30 photos and I finally got one. I just pointed at the sky and just started clicking my camera.
Well,
and I got a couple good ones.
That was the problem too, since there was cloud coverage, you couldn't necessarily see exactly where the sun is. So you'd move your glasses, put them down, move your glasses, and you're like, I can't see. Where is it?
See, that's the exact same amount. I see that when that see,
yeah,
it could affect us all now.
Walking down Michigan Avenue today. Watching people do that.
Were they doing
it? I was doing it on Michigan Avenue, too. Yeah, it was quite the scene. Because it was eerie. It was just everybody stopped what they were doing. Like, nobody was moving on Michigan
Avenue. And it was humid,
so
it was kind of a weird temperature.
Yeah, it was weird.
It was really, really cloudy, so I wonder if the warning went down a little bit in Chicago.
I don't know.
In terms of the damage it
could do? Yeah, because, I mean, it was so cloudy that... I don't know that you could see it. It was even difficult to see through the glasses to pinpoint, where it was.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
do you have any light sensitivity?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eye pain?
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay, you're in trouble.
Are you seeing spots?
24 hours later. You got to wait.
With the exception of this one big spot, I don't know.
Go look at the sun again.
I'm also having a dental issue, too, on top of everything else.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I don't even know what to do. I don't know where to go, to the eye doctor or to the dentist first. I'm just not sure.
We had a caller over the weekend, and he's a welder, and he suggested if you do suffer any burn to the eye,
mm-hmm.
To drop half and half drops in your eye.
Like the milk?
I'm sorry, what?
Half and half drops
like cream
in
like that you drop in the coffee?
Exactly,
just
like
to
what you
soothe
drop in
them
it, yeah.
to make them feel better?
Bro, go get some.
Seems like the stupidest idea
ever.
Yeah,
we weren't endorsing this, but the welder insisted that that's what they do.
It's an instant cooling effect. Try it.
Half and half in the eyeball. Give it a shot. What's the worst?
Come on, bro. What's the worst? You just stared at the sun.
This is like what Jim Baker was selling.
Then you get half and half that you put in your eyes so you don't see the eternal flames of hell burning.
Return your sight.
What could go wrong?
Your sight will be restored.
Special Jim Baker, half and half. In powder form.
He does. He sounds like a very angry Ted Cruz.
He does.
Scarier.
Yeah.
A lot.
We don't like him.
No.
A lot more.
I don't like him.
Mm-mm. Bring Ted Cruz back. I never thought I'd say that.
Thank you, Anna.
You're welcome.
Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis, 720 WGN. I brought my guitar in today. Just decided to play a little something for you. Yeah.
Do you play any instruments? The recorder? Nothing?
Are you talking about yourself, Violetta, or are you
answering
for me?
Yes, I play the recorder.
Yeah.
Is it tough to play half a blind row?
It is, now that I'm have again,
well,
another
blind musicians.
That's true.
That's good.
I would not be one of them. This is incredibly heroic of me. Since
a show
I know,
of bravery.
A show of bravery, since I fear that I have lost sight in one eye by staring at the eclipse today.
Dear God.
That's
you
like
too.
My favorite story of the day.
I know. After all of the warnings that came out of your mouth, Kevin was about to throw up. He was like, come on, enough. And then look.
And then Rosie looked at me with the leaves and the glasses, and I wasn't sure how to use everything. It's really simple.
Well, the thing is, you can't, once you see it for the first time, if you don't have the right, the problem is, what had happened was, when you don't have the right equipment and yet you have sunglasses on, but you've seen it the first time, you're like, that's fascinating. I got to go look at that.
Yeah, you're like, it's right there. I have to look up.
I can't stop looking. And the next thing you know.
By the way, thanks
blind
to
in one eye.
A listener, the passengers on Southwest Airlines Solar Eclipse Flight were in fact given special glasses and a cocktail.
A cocktail. That's what I'm missing.
Hopefully they could stop.
Yeah, you would have been staring at it directly for a longer period of time.
Look through the bottom of the glass. It'll be fine.
That's what I would have done, which would have probably just exaggerated the problem.
Yeah, they offered the Red Sky, Bloody Mary, the Stargazer sparkling wine, and the Sun Flare, vodka, and OJ.
I like the way they roll.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I hope the pilot didn't have one.
Yes, I'm sure he did not.
I hope he had special glasses. Imagine if you're flying. Can't.
They all wear those glasses anyway. You always see those.
Dark glasses.
You always have them on. Hey, I wanted to bring our own Richard Roper in on the story today, the death of, you wrote a really beautiful piece today, actually. Interesting and beautiful piece, because Jerry Lewis's passing is an interesting moment in popular culture history for the United States and for American culture and Western culture, really, when you think about it, because he was gigantic in France, as he always used to like to say.
Yes, he did.
But I think people don't realize, I mean, he's generations knew him as the guy from the telethon, and sort of as a cranky old man from the telethon. But Jerry Lewis changed cinema in a lot of ways, didn't he?
He really did. If you go back to the even late 40s when he first teamed up with Dean Martin, they were filling 6,000 or 7,000 seat arenas on a weekly basis with their routine that was then perfected in something like 15 or 16 movies that were like huge hits. I mean, it was guaranteed moneymakers for the studios. And then, of course, Jerry and Dean had this tremendous breakup because Lewis kept getting bigger and bigger roles in the movies. Dean Martin was the straight man. And then he launched that solo career, Ro, where, you know, I try to explain to people, like, he was Eddie Murphy and Robin Williams and Jim Carrey-level superstar. I mean, he was writing, directing, and starring in movies like, you know, The Nutty Professor, which, you know, to this day I think is just a classic comedy.
And The Nutty Professor, that version of it, we played a little clip of it, and it's a little hard to tell. It was not quite as consumer-friendly,
no.
Even though it was a Disney film. I mean, it was the original, like the Walt Disney era of those films, where Walt Disney did not play. Walt Disney did not want to be experimental. Walt Disney would have never given the green light to Pretty Woman, as that company did, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. And I think, you know, that was something subversive about the film and about Jerry Lewis. It's kind of an underrated genius because, you know, it was an update on Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but it really contained a lot of elements. It was, you know, a lot of people thought it was Jerry Lewis kind of examining his relationship with Dean Martin and that buddy love character was Dean Martin. But, you know, Jerry Lewis himself later said, no, it was really more an exploration of Jerry Lewis, who thought of himself as the bumbling, you know, socially awkward professor, but then had this image, you know, as actually a kind of a suave, sophisticated, you know, Vegas hipster kind of guy. But he always felt like he was fooling everybody, just like almost every big, giant showbiz comedian does. So when you go back and watch it, I mean, Buddy Love is a horrible creature. You know?
Right, we played a clip. He was pretty awful.
Yeah.
And Rich, I know you touched on this in your column, but he seemed like he was grumpy at times when giving interviews, and he wasn't all about the promotion all the time. And Roe had a specific example of him being sort of a cantankerous fellow when he was trying to be interviewed, and didn't always get into that side of the biz.
Oh, he was famous for that. You know, I mean, look, that breakup with Dean Martin. Dean Martin, you know, by all accounts, was in real life a laid-back guy who would drink a glass of warm milk more often than he'd actually drink. And he didn't talk to Jerry Lewis for 10 years, and they reconciled, but never really, really got close again. And if you go back, some of the telethon stuff, he raised $2.5 billion for a great cause, for MDA. But sometimes on that telethon itself, he would be berating Ed McMahon. He'd be ripping the director. He once said to one of the kids who was coming out there, "Can you hurry it up?" And this was a child using braces to walk across the stage.
Oh,
and then he kind of made a joke. And he went, "Can't you walk?" And he kind of tried to make it seem like he was being funny, but it was like appalling to watch sometimes.
I can only imagine.
It got weirder, and it had become by the 80s and 90s, it had become almost a cultish thing to watch, because he became this, he became this cantankerous, mean guy. He treated Ed McMahon like Ed McMahon was not just a hired help, but it was, I swear to God, it was like Roots. It was like
awful to watch
his treatment of him. And they would always do with the drunk jokes and all the rest of that stuff, which Ed McMahon, a little play on what the way Carson sort of treated Ed McMahon, but there was still an abiding sort of respect. And it was Carson pulling it off as opposed to, this once a year kind of thing where everybody was tired and weird. And like I said earlier, Ed McMahon just told St. Peter, when Jerry Lewis gets here, don't tell him I'm here. I do not want to see him.
And then, he over the years, he'd fade from favor, but then his career would be resurrected, of course, most famously with The King of Comedy, the Martin Scorsese film, where he was kind of playing his version of what Johnny Carson would be like if Jerry Lewis had become Johnny Carson.
Right.
So you're almost rooting for Rupert Pupkin and Sandra Bernhard's character who kidnapped him. You were kind of rooting for them.
Right. Because he wasn't afraid to be a bad guy. I know a lot of comics are like that, famously Sam Kinison, people like that, would do things to lose the audience and then win them back.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think Jerry cared if he ever won anybody back, because he had made that turn in his career from being the, sort of the cute, almost childlike character, baby childlike character, to be, and sort of the innocent and all of that. And then he made the turn to being this kind of a creepier middle-aged man. As a filmmaker, and this is where we go back to, is the art stands by itself, as you point out in your column today in the Sun Times, the art stands by itself because, and he was never he was never accused of, being a molester or any kind of things that other people get accused of being, but he was just not in public favor. But when you go back and you look at the Lewis and Martin films, which are really, or Martin and Lewis, I guess is what it was, which bothered them both,
exactly.
Who got top billing. But the Martin and Lewis films, they're very entertaining to watch. They can just wash across you. They're sort of in that almost Elvis Presley-esque kind of film, but they're even funnier because there's a little dark, because both of those are dark figures.
Yes, absolutely. And, there's another thing that didn't get mentioned a lot in all the tributes, but as I mentioned, as a filmmaker, he was actually a pioneer. Jerry Lewis was the first director on a film set to bring in videotape machines to record scenes on the spot so they could play them back on location and then decide if they wanted to reshoot it a different way. He was the first director to ever do that. Every filmmaker ever since then has done that. They film the movie or they shoot it on digital, whatever the case may be. But there's a control room just like for a sporting event, and they can go and watch the scene they just shot in real time. He was the guy who came up with that.
Yeah.
Gosh, that's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, and you think about it was sort of like the way Desi Arnaz came up with the 3-camera shoot for sitcom for television use, which they had never been used before. And you think, now, how is that possible that these guys have a vision, have a certain vision,
right.
And there was no way that Jerry Lewis was any less than a genius. A cranky genius, and certainly one who'd been told that so many times in his life that he was really firmly in understanding of his geniusness. But he was he was that guy. And in the end, it was interesting. You mentioned there was the most awkward moment ever when he and Dean Martin had the reunion, because it was on television when it happened.
Yeah, it really, it was nobody was really buying it. And, you know, he always claimed, well, we kept in touch until the very end, but I think it was very sporadic. There was, you know, Dean Martin, as you know, would go to dinner every night at the same restaurant in Hollywood, I think, for like the last 15 years of his life. And there was never a moment where people said, oh, when Jerry Lewis joined him. And up until the end, just, I think the last interview Jerry Lewis ever gave was about 6 months ago, and you can look it up online. It was the Hollywood Reporter.
Oh, yeah.
A reporter. I think you guys played audio from that.
They called it the most painfully awkward interview of 2016.
They go to his house in Vegas, and the crew sets up and everything, and the guy starts asking questions, and every answer is yes. No.
Right.
And then they kept rolling as he goes, we're done. And then he goes, and then he's like kicking the elbow, going, how long is it going to take you to get this crap out of my house? And the poor camera guys are like trying to fold up all
scrambling.
The out of there. It's, you know, like, would you change anything? No. Do you have any regrets? No. What's your favorite film? Don't know. It was like, I think he just had them over like a cat likes to have a dead mouse to play with.
And why did he do it, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's because that's where he was. Well, Jerry Lewis, dead at the age of, how old was
91.
He? 91.
Long life.
All right. God bless him.
Yes.
He entertained a lot of people. We'll leave it at that. Richard Roper, very well. You should go look at it at sometimes.com and see the column today about it because it really is interesting. All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Rich. Appreciate
it. See you later this week. Bye-bye.
All right.